Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting. Hello, welcome to the big show from the British Tech Network. I'm Ewan Rankin, and I'm here to guide you through the week's technology, ably assisted by a fantastic bunch of individuals who are girded, ready to go. And we've got a new boy. We're going to send him down to the tool room for a long wait. Joining me, top left, starting with Mr. Hart. How you doing, bud?
Good evening, Ewan. And good evening, listener. And please, before you listen to this show, would you like to receive a cookie from me?
A cookie. We'll be talking cookie legislation.
Oh, yes.
The number of chocolate chips required per centimetre squared in cookies.
Don't leave it outside because it's damp.
Along with striped bananas. Next to James, we have new boy, John Hume. How you doing, pal?
Evening. Very well, thank you.
Web entrepreneur and aficionado and guru.
I try. I prefer ninja, actually. But yeah,
web ninja. That's just... I don't know if that's a bit done now or not, though. While Fruit Ninja's out, Fruit Ninja's my pick of the day, actually, tonight. But while Fruit Ninja's around, you can still have it. Don't worry, mate.
Thank you.
And next to him, Sarah Gray.
So I guess I must also be a ninja as well, then.
I know it's a girl. Do you have girl ninjas?
I don't know.
You do now. How's things?
Things are swimmingly.
How's QPR doing?
Well, we beat Spurs last weekend, so it can't be bad.
Yeah, they're only a man down there.
We might stay up.
You might. Then again. And finally, from warm, sunny Petaluma, but with two layers on, Eric Lanigan.
How's it going? It's a little bit cool again today. It's about, I don't know, 60 or so?
300,
windy.
Yeah.
Well, hey, they're not heavy layers. It's like a little sweatshirt. What are you talking about?
Yeah, big girl's blouse.
It's relative over there, isn't it?
Right. Well, it was funny. Actually, it was 90 last week, and the week before it was 50. So that's what you get around this time of year.
We've been raining,
and with global climate change.
This time last week and up until now, it's been raining in Britain.
Nothing but rain.
Mostly but rain. They said it's got to rain for like 40 days and 40 nights to get the reservoirs back up. But I passed a reservoir this week in Nottingham, and it was up well and good. There was no problem with it at all. And it's been raining hard for a long time now, a very long time. So
I heard a good joke about that 40-day, 40-night thing and the arc being used to refloat the economy after the news this week about being
double dip. There we go.
I thought it was quite good.
Though we said that double dipping was bad for you. So there we go. The week in technology. Where have we gone and what have we done? Well, the Daily Mail is screaming for a ban on porn. Opponents are suggesting the Daily Mail. Good God! Opponents are suggesting that access to porn is too readily available and it's damaging society, degrading to women, and there's far too much amateur content on there. They want more professionally produced content, I guess.
Absolutely. Where did that one come from?
Now, the quote is that there's something deeply upsetting about ministers' willingness to accept the industry's arguments against a law to protect children from pornography. So they've played the children card. Jolly good.
Let's face it, guys, if you heard about that story and said that had come from a British newspaper, you're going to know which one it's come from, aren't you?
So the Express is probably, even that's probably a little bit too left-wing for the Express. The supporters of the bill include Pamela Anderson, Abby Titmus, Kim Kishardian and Talisa. They're all into it. So far...
I can hear the hand wringing from here.
So far, only Leslie Grantham's come out against it. There we go.
That's the people they've asked.
That's not the kind of picture you want if you're having your dinner.
No.
Microsoft have released Security Essentials 4. That's available for download. If you like, it's their free stuff to keep you safe on the web. We'll have a chat about that because we're doing a bit of web security as well today. They've been pretty quiet over the virus scandal, of course, for Apple recently and not trying to dump on Tim Cook. They've also warned that they've discovered a new Mac virus called the Boheka virus. And finally, Microsoft have come out and admitted that it's just a rumour, and they actually made it up as a joke. Boheka stands up for bend over, here it comes again. So they're looking to get Apple. And also, Microsoft have released their scan and match service for Xbox users for music. Wouldn't you just love to be the bloke on the left, Allard? He doesn't look happy at all at the launch of the Zune there. Redmond has confirmed, this is not a joke, this is the truth. Redmond has confirmed the new feature will enable users to find songs from within their current library.
Shock horror.
I'm not kidding you, that's on the press release.
It's about time.
Does that imply that they couldn't before or something?
Fergal Sharkey must be upset as well that people can actually find music that they paid for now. But that is from the press release. The facility will find songs from within their current library. That's it.
Maybe the guy on the left can't find the music he's looking for. That's why he's looking so miserable.
Oh, he knows that's failing right from the start, doesn't he? Why has he made me hold this?
Bill says I wanted to work it out.
There it is.
And finally,
why are the eyes of them in focus on that photo?
I've blown it up quite a bit, to be fair. That's not helped. And finally, Tim, who is the Trustworthy Internet Movement, has published a whole pile of data about sites that are not good. They're not safe and secure. They're going to shame them as well. They're going to name and shame them. They haven't actually done it yet, though. They've just promised that they're going to. Apparently, 90% of websites are not using SSL. 92% of websites are incomplete certificate chains. And 75% of them are open to beast attacks.
Beast attacks?
Yeah, I watched Twilight last night, so I figure I know what that is now.
It was just this, I think it was this time last year, we were discussing the fact that Facebook and Twitter hadn't moved over to HTTPS. They've done it now, but every now and then you still get the little cross and the red thing to say, I haven't made a successful secure connection. You're just going, this is bonkers.
Only 10% of websites. I mean, that's a low. I mean, they polled 198,000 websites, so they've done a fair old size survey, it has to be said. But 179 of them were totally insecure.
My wife's made a very good, she will never use public Wi-Fi on her phone because you don't know where that's, you know, if it's sent to plain text, the router could be picking up everything she's doing.
My wife
because
is happy.
Because the websites aren't free, aren't encrypted.
My wife is happy she's got me hand-me-down iPhone 4 at the moment, so she wouldn't. If you said to her SSL, she would think it was something to do with the Second World War. Yes, absolutely no idea. So very well aware for Poots. Well done, mate. This thing, the Trustworthy Internet Movement, I've never heard of them before, I have to say.
No.
Well, you're all shaking your heads, but apparently they're prominent. They're the big bigs. They've put this survey, and it's 40% cipher strength only. Sites with keys below 1024 bits as well were most of them. Extended validation certificates were only covered by 8% of sites. Key strength distributions were below, only 19 sites had adequate control. And beast attack 75%. I don't know what any of that means. I have no clue. But I mean, so John, you're our ninja, and Sarah, you're our ninja S. Any significance in all of this stuff? Is SSL really worth having?
I'm surprised it's as many sites as that, to be honest, that passed. Facebook, and like James mentioned, Facebook have made a bit of an effort in trying to move over to SSL, but it doesn't always work. Yet they still inflict that on anyone that creates an app for them. So if you make a Facebook app and you have your own SSL certificate for it, the user gets warnings to scare them off actually using it. But they can't even seem to maintain it themselves, which is quite interesting. Mm. But I think there's a lot of sites out there that don't have adequate security. It's very common. Clients just don't want to pay for it, sadly. So, unless you're doing something mission critical, banking or e-commerce, outside of that, it's pretty difficult to get them to take it seriously. So,
yeah, I think part of that is the fact is that they do make it understandably very difficult, the hoops you have to jump through to actually get an SSL certificate. I think that's quite important that they do, because otherwise it undermines the value of having the SSL certificate in the first place.
Go ahead, James.
Yeah. I was going to say, incidentally, a beast attack is a browser exploit against SSL or TLS. So basically, it's something they run within the browser that tries to decrypt what it is. And where it does my head in is, I guess, Sarah, your point where it's really difficult to get a certificate stands. But it's not hard to encrypt a web page. Everybody, the technology's been there for, well, since the Second World War, as DT says. No. I don't know why they don't use decent length encryption strings and make it so it's possible to... I mean, the standards must be out there, surely.
Yeah, it's not, the, it's, it's not the work isn't the hard bit. It's, I think, persuading people that they need to do it is have traditionally been more difficult for us, I think. And also, it's difficult sometimes to, as Sarah said, to actually get the certificates in the first place. There's a lot of hoops to jump through. You have to fill in, you know, various different forms. You need to have people sign off on it from your, you, to buy it on behalf of somebody else. They make that virtually impossible for you for a reason. And then we quite regularly found ourselves working with people in IT departments at various organizations that, you know, that it's not top of their radar. It's difficult to get things done. And you have to have, there's loads of stupid things. Like if you're going to create an SSL certificate on a subdomain, you have to have an email address that works on that subdomain. And you can only pick from like two or three bits before the at. It has to be like info or admin. And it's really picky.
Sometimes there's reverse DNS doesn't work on that.
Yeah. It's so picky. It's pretty awful. So yeah, particularly if you want to do things with US providers, like we use Rackspace, it's particularly difficult there as well. So proceed with caution, but definitely.
There used to be international legislation about encryption as well on the internet, didn't there? I think the US certainly didn't like it because it was making data unavailable to them if they wanted to snoop on it. I guess that softened up a little bit with the advent of all the amount of financial transactions that go on.
I think BlackBerry had a bit of trouble as well, didn't they? And not too distant past for encrypting stuff and certain governments wanting them to have access to it. So yeah, there's a balancing act, definitely. But I think people take it seriously, like I said, when they really feel that they need to. So transactional sites, or banking, e-commerce, or stuff where you're giving away particularly sensitive information, you really have got to do it. And I think most people do. I think it's more everything else, you know, places that just collect your data maybe don't take it seriously enough. And there's legislation in place to protect everybody, so there's really no excuse for it.
So just to be clear and go back to explain to a fairly simpleton person about this. Now, I mean, I know that you said about the World War II thing for the Enigma machine, there were secure socket layers, but my understanding was it was actually created a bit more in GCHQ by a guy, but he couldn't sell it, and eventually some Americans figured it out and they charged for it. And it was originally the tiny padlock that would appear in the corner if you tried to do transactions and so on PayPal, etc. originally. Correct?
You still get the padlock.
Yeah, no, but that's what I'm saying. That's what it is. So they developed it as a commercial venture. An HTTPS now is the future for the net, perhaps, but are they starting to you know, hog it and monopolize it and detract from it? You know, is the monopoly taking place there with SSL?
That is an interesting question. I don't know. I think seems to be, you know, it seems to be the way that most people want to do it. I think it's you know, it is simple enough to actually implement it. Like I said, it's just the problems are up front. And once you get past that, it's easy to do. So I think SSL is definitely the way.
Apart from the fact that you do have to go through those loops every couple of years. It's not just a one-off do it and then that's it, because they want to make sure that the you know, that you are still who you say you are and that you've still got a right to use it.
And is it cost prohibitive though?
Not especially. I mean, it can be quite expensive, but also you have hierarchies as well. So you get organizations that can allocate sub-licenses to be able to issue certificates. So there's quite a hierarchy involved.
So it's like domain resellers kind of thing.
But it's not as extensive.
You look at a company like VeriSign is the sort of the definitive.
They are one of
them,
and Suite as well.
So they're going to name and shame the websites that aren't using it. And from what you're saying, John and Sarah, there's a significant number of websites here are going to have egg on their face, and we're probably in there as well as. Is it kind of beating an old lady with a stick? You know, it's not really a fair fight here. They could have predicted that this was going to be the outcome long before. I mean, John, you're saying that you estimated it at 10%, actually a very high amount.
Yeah, that's probably a bit more than what I would have guessed. Yeah. I think because of that sort of traditional approach whereby only certain sites would bother to have security of any real magnitude, I don't think it's a real surprise that not a lot of places do, particularly when, you know, as James mentioned, the real big boys have really only turned on to having it quite recently. So Google and Facebook forcing it and making it their default proposition really didn't come until last year. So it's no real surprise to me at all.
I think the other aspect as well is that, as James said, we were talking about this a year ago. I think then we were talking about the fact that you could go to a site like Twitter and Facebook, and until you actually logged in, it wasn't using the SSL certificate and secure site. This is a problem which now that the big boys have fixed, but the smaller organizations or with lesser presence or don't care about it as much haven't yet cottoned on to that point, and that's the weak point in the link. And if there is any publishing of and just naming shame of sites like this, then those are the ones that are going to get shown up.
Mm-hmm. See, what I'm trying to do is put it into perspective with all the other different malignant social engineering and hacking that goes on the internet. There are constantly people trying to undermine blogs, phishing, all these different means by which people are trying to get data, information, and credit card details, obviously, and money off people. I wonder where it sits in that hierarchy. Is it? I guess because it's
is it any good or not?
It will be. It is. Well, it's likely to be the higher value data they're going for. So it's bigger fish, but fewer of them, really. Because, I mean, I believe there was an attack on PayPal. Somebody managed to get, I was reading one of the articles, they were saying they managed to get PayPal authentication, login and password in 2 minutes. That's frightening.
Well, I mean, I've lost money through PayPal on three occasions now, and we're talking £2,000 worth has gone out buying sunglasses, camera equipment, etc. And I've got all my money back. Well done to PayPal. Thank you very much. Mm. But they said, oh, you know, you must make sure your password's secure. No, trust me, my password is secure. It's secure with me because it's stuck on under my table in my desk here in the office. But and I took it down for the bash last year. So, but it's not me that's leaking it. You know, I'm damn sure that it's them that's giving the password out. It's not me. Is SSL going to stop all of that, or is that just still? You know, PayPal.
SSL is in place. It's just low. It's just not thick enough. It's not. It can be broken because of these exploits. It's as simple as that. Brute force can break them at this stage. The keys aren't long enough for people to attack. And that's the thing that I don't really understand, because if you're going to generate a key, why don't you generate a decent one? Mm-hmm. 40 bits is not enough anymore.
One of the reasons I haven't said much right now is because I don't really have anything to say about this. But the other reason is I've been trying to look up something. I knew I read this somewhere and I couldn't remember where. It was from opendns.com, because I was reading about the DNS exploits, Flash something or other, the new Mac virus, the new Mac malware is called that.
Flashback,
yeah. And it takes over your DNS and what can you do to protect that? And I was reading how OpenDNS, that free service, advertises that they will protect you from spyware and from malware and malicious websites, because they will block it in their DNS block list. And when I was just happening on their site reading about it, they talked about DNSSEC and DNSCrypt as two competing or maybe complementary technologies. They prefer DNSCrypt, and they use elliptical curve cryptography. I haven't heard about any of this. Do you guys know what this means?
No, I'm familiar with why you would want to use another DNS server, but not necessarily with elliptical curve encryption.
I have.
Would encrypting the DNS traffic help in the ways you're talking about?
I have heard of elliptical curve cryptography, but it is a very new concept.
I dare say it prevents spoofing, but there's an interesting point raised in the chat room by Paul S. Davies. He's saying, certificate admin and hassle, but the main issue is the amount of extra processing power needed at or near the web server. And that makes a very good point, because if you are dealing with hundreds of thousands of customers, to put the processing power in required to carry out the transactions that carry out the anti-spoofing measures is probably going to double, if not quadruple, the amount of processing power, you know, the amount of stock or iron or tin that's needed to do the job, which could be done much more simply with less security.
I mean, it's mainly designed to stop things like man-in-the-middle attacks and all sorts of stuff like that. It's not, as somebody actually said in the chat room, it's not going to stop somebody from hacking your password if you're careless enough to allow stuff to be installed on your PC. It doesn't matter what you do. There's nothing that can prevent that.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I think that we can talk about this, you know, at length, but there's nothing out there that's even going to touch the stats of the number of people that just give their password away without even realizing it. And that's
the kind of point I was trying to make earlier.
Yeah,
it's the big fish. If you can get people's accounts, rather than asking them, can I have your password, please? Go on then.
Yeah, or people that just are giving it away because without realizing it, because they've got malware or something on their system that's doing that, or they're sending stuff in the clear without realizing it.
Are we getting to the stage where the SSL and all of the other methods of encryption are taken to the point that your processor power is starting to get eaten up by them just physically getting in and out of the sites? To actually maintain them and hold them and keep them secure, or are we saying that it's worth it? Or are we saying that a driven, motivated attack on a site, none of this will make any difference anyway?
I actually think that one of the good reasons for having all this CPU power, even in our phones now and in our laptops, and I mean everywhere, we have more CPU than we can even use for basic web browsing. Why don't we throw it at higher security? We do that with video. That's what we've done with better and better H.264 codecs over the years. We've thrown more bits. Apple, their devices have in the background gradually gone from baseline to main to now high profile 1080p playback, basically throwing more CPU cycles at the beginning and for the compression and the decompression in order to save that middle transfer over the internet. So maybe that is a solution. What do you guys think?
Anyone?
I guess that's not.
Good question.
I would venture that unfortunately to implement client side, well, what there is server side encryption is actually fairly easy to implement because there is a set of instructions that's already there. Client-side encryption would require each of the clients to have the same encryption system, and to get them to agree on anything would be a hell of a challenge. That's all I guess is in theory, brilliant. In practice, I dare say you'd be fighting an uphill battle trying to do it, unless Tim can get everybody to point in the right direction.
Where does some kind of a universal login like Facebook's trying to do fit into this? Do you think that's going to be more or less popular as a result of these lax security measures?
Using what login?
Using like a universal login where you log in to like, say, Facebook once, and then that's your passport to all sorts of secure websites.
I was going to say, is one password not
that's
a third?
That's OpenID type thing, isn't it, Eric?
Is that not a one password-esque kind of thing? You end up with a third party with a set of authorized third party providers who provide the client end user interface.
I think I'd probably prefer Facebook not to do it. I'd prefer somebody.
We'd always prefer Facebook not to do something. I mean, agreed.
I think the thing is with OpenID that what they prefer you to do is, and this is something I've actually done, is actually set up on your own site where you can authenticate through your own site. And all it needs is a little piece of software installed, which you can download and install in PHP, ASP, whatever you're actually using. And then you can actually authenticate through your own site.
Mm.
And that's the preferred way of doing it. And certainly, I mean, I don't have a problem with Google, but I'm certainly not going to trust people like Facebook to authenticate accounts for other accounts that I've got across the internet.
I wouldn't trust Facebook I don't trust them with any pictures, let alone authenticating transactions. Blimey.
Ewan, you know my view on Apple. Well, my view on Facebook isn't much far behind.
Right. Totally good.
Daily Mail's, if the Daily Mail has anything to do with it, it'll all be shut down.
Yeah, they're too obsessed with porn at the minute, so. In a good way, allegedly. Allegedly. I tell you what would be really cracking, wouldn't it, is if now that they've got this crusade going on, someone hacked one of the computers in the Daily Mail room and found it just crammed with pornography. You know, one of the janitors goes in at night or something, or in the morning, and starts cleaning up and sitting there looking at something really inappropriate. John, you wanted to talk about cookies. What have you got to say about cookies? Because this is your pet hate or something.
Not my pet hate, but it's something that we're having to deal with actually this week, preparing what our recommendations are going to be to our clients. And we were asked about it in the chat room before we started. And it's very, very confusing and not even slightly clear what is happening with cookies. But I suppose while we're talking about internet security, it makes a bit of sense to finish it off with that, I guess. But there is legislation coming into force shortly that's been put up by the European Union, and it's been given out for all the governments within Europe to then enforce in their own countries. And our government, in its wisdom, along with the Information Commission, the ICO, they have taken quite a long time to come to a decision, and even now they're still being very ambiguous about how they're approaching it. So what they want everybody to do is anytime that you use a cookie, is to ask permission. And so what will happen with UK websites or European websites is that you'll end up with pop-ups constantly. So every time you go to a site, you end up getting a pop-up. And every time that someone wants to track you with Google Analytics or with any other third-party tracking software, you'll have to give permission for it. And it's not good enough just to put it in your terms and conditions. You really actually have to make it really obvious. So it's going to be a big change for a lot of websites in the UK particularly, and really only a few people are doing it so far. So the example I put in the chat room was Delia Smith. Her website is one that that uses it to the letter of the law, as well as the actual ICO website. But there's not that many. The BBC have done bits with it. They've started to say that they're working on it on a few of their sites, but they haven't actually gone and implemented it the full way. And the reason why is that they're waiting, I guess, to see what happens. And it's quite a confusing time for a lot of people at the moment as to what actually is required and what's not required. So be
as
prepared.
With all these things, it's a game of chicken, really, isn't it? Either everybody's going to start doing it, or someone's going to get prosecuted. And it depends which way it goes.
Yeah, you'd be surprised how many cookies get dropped every time you go to a site, particularly just for tracking. There's a really good plugin for Chrome called Ghostery that you can install. Mm. And whenever you go to a site, it gives you a really small pop-up in the top right-hand corner that shows you. And particularly on new sites, like if you go to The Sun or any of the other major red tops, you will see there's maybe 12 or 15 different advertising tracking cookies that get dropped every time you go. So
I disabled that plugin within minutes.
It's scary, isn't it, Eric? It's really
there's just too many pop-ups. You go to every site and it's like cookie, 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 cookie.
Yeah, I know, but that's still good that you actually have that. I use that as well, and in fact, it was my cool thingy some time ago for that very reason, because at least that way you're actually knowing what's going on.
Surprising how many companies you've never heard of must have so much information about you.
John, what's your opinion on Apple's somewhat unpopular stance, depends on who you ask. Advertising networks obviously hate it, and with some websites, that they, by default, have been the only web browser to disable third-party cookies by default.
I'm not really a big fan of third-party cookies, to be honest. We try to really keep it to a minimum where we can. So, to be honest, it's nice for them to do it, but I think people have to have a choice at the end of the day.
I think you say that. Don't companies make money out of these third-party cookies?
A lot of people, their entire business is the third-party cookies. But I think what the effort would be better spent actually educating the consumer and letting them know what their choices are.
Yeah.
And saying to them, and providing,
right.
And in a similar way to when Internet Explorer got a lot of heat for being the default browser installed, the first time you use a browser, you could ask the user, you know, what are your preferences on this? And then you could periodically remind them. And it wouldn't be so much effort, but the heat has all fallen onto the businesses to in order to change their websites themselves, when really this could have been done through education and through the browsers, and it would have taken a lot less effort for everybody concerned. The control's already there. I think it's just about bringing it to the forefront and educating people as to why they would want to do it, and just helping people make good choices. So at the moment, it's all very cloak and dagger. So
I mean, basically, you've got three different things. You've got your cookies, which are you need to be able to do the job. They say that the strictly necessary ones, for example, if you put an item in a basket, it needs to go, a cookie needs to be delivered so that it can be retained there. Apparently, that doesn't need a warning. Then you have the on-site cookies that allow for browser customization. You click something and it remembers that you've done it. And that requires permission. And then you've got these third-party cookies, stuff that turns up because of advertising in banners down the side of your web page. That's a hell of a lot of cookies.
Have we not got a situation here, though, that's more like Little Snitch, you know, in the fact that this is going to require so much authentication, so much acceptance, that people in the end are just going to say, look, tell you what, stuff it, have it. You know, and just, it's going to become a habit to click, go, okay. Because generally speaking, right or wrong, people trust websites.
Well, that's it's not as if this is coming under the radar. It's something which has been here since HTTP, HTML 2. The cookies are a mainstay of the World Wide Web, not the internet.
Yeah, I mean, since we've gone from a flat.
Hello? Who stopped?
I stopped because I thought James was talking.
Blimey, that was spooky. Carry on, Sarah.
Since we've gone from the original design that Tim Berners-Lee came up for the web, which was just basically flat content, to trying to do more and more and more with the web, we cannot operate without cookies. It's absolutely not essential. I mean, one of the approaches I've heard discussed is, and it's a bit radical, but is saying, well, if you don't like cookies and you don't accept it, you can't do anything on the site.
I mean, there are lots of websites where that'll actually be a fact that can't be avoided. There's a lot of particularly more advanced functionality where if you can't have an open session that you maintain, then you just can't do anything. So there will be sites that actually end up turning people away because of it.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of sites at the moment, though, that if you don't accept cookies with them, if you've not got cookies turned on, then won't you look at any of their content regardless? And none of that content requires cookies to be enabled to look at it. I mean, that should be illegal.
I mean, it is actually good that it's making websites actually think about it. However, I do think, like I think has already been said, most people, they just want to find whatever it is they're looking for. And if it means they've got to accept that, they'll just do that in the same way that they would tick to say they agree with terms and conditions to do whatever it is they want to do on a particular site. So it becomes meaningless in the end.
And it's important to remember that the vast majority of people who go to a website just to find something that they know they're looking for have no knowledge of what goes on behind the scenes. They have no knowledge that
that's
they're
what
even
I'm saying, Eric.
Most people think the internet is completely anonymous, actually. You hear people get arrested because like they've been Googling how to murder somebody and then they find the body, you know? People that just have no idea how traceable everything is, or that what they're doing, that they're being identified from site to site, or even that things like personal information are being traded company to company. The amount of ad servers that know your unique phone ID, for instance, for ad-supported applications, people just don't know what data is traded about them behind the scenes.
Chat room wants to know, Eric, how do you murder someone?
Well, Google it and find out.
And DT's suggesting someone will just develop a browser plugin that simply accepts all cookies. And I've got to say, that's got a mass appeal.
Mm. Absolutely, yes.
It's not as stupid as it sounds.
Tick box. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing that bothers me is that the evidence of what's going on with cookies. Very few. My mother hasn't got a clue what a cookie is beyond the obvious pun of chocolate chip. And it's crazy to suggest that she would be able to cope with anything. And if anything pops up, my mother's default is to click cancel because she doesn't know what's happened. And I think there's probably going to be a plenty of 60 to 80 year olds there, the silver surfers who have got liberated through, the freedom accessibility of iPad and those kind of devices and laptops and netbooks, dare I say it. And they'll be castrated effectively from the net.
Mm. I think there's another aspect as well, is the jurisdiction that these sites actually are on. I mean, if you've got a site that actually, for instance, if I created a website on a host that is actually in the US, where does the law stand on that? Because the site actually lives in the US. The EU have no jurisdiction over the US. So how would they enforce that, even though it's my site?
You don't want to tell the EU things like that. They'll just ban all the sites from the US.
No. All I'm saying is that it becomes even more difficult to police. And that's something that, I mean, obviously in public sector, it's a bit different. But in the commercial world, are we not going to affect the businesses of the, this becomes really onerous. Are we not going to, is this directive not going to affect the ability of domain hosts in the UK, in the EU? To compete against those outside the EU.
I think it's a great point there. I mean, if you look at the legislation that there is within the EU, you've got that Article 81 stuff that says that we've got to have a level playing field. You know, the Germans have been called Christ knows how many times for restrictive practices and trying to leverage German products and so on. If we're talking about the net being the World Wide Web, then we need a legislation which is not bipartisan. It's truly global.
Hmm. I mean, look at this.
It's such a difficult thing to achieve, though.
It's impossible.
I mean, look at China.
It's impossible.
It's exactly the same thing with all the issues we've had about, about issues about music and, terms gone from my mind. A protection of trying to protect music and videos and stuff like that. Yeah, that sort of stuff. Yeah, sorry. Thanks, James. Yeah, SOPA and stuff like that. I mean, the jurisdiction's complete because the web is, the internet is completely, there's no limitation around the world. It's impossible to enforce that kind of stuff.
I think there's a good point in the chat room from Max there saying, doesn't it depend on where the company operates, not where the site server is? And I think that's it's a good point to make, but I think there's so many loopholes around that in terms of the majority of these kind of activities are oriented to purchases and to advertiser use. I saw a demonstration of some stuff a little while ago where the software actually, the cookie that was there was actually tracking where people hovered before they clicked, and to see what was the prior, I can't remember what they called it, but it was like the distractor, you know, what was the distraction before they went to their final purchase, and then where the location was on the screen, and then what prominence that had, the 3-5 ratio stuff. So all you've got to say is, well, hang on, you know, we only take orders off the website, you know, the website management and the customer profiling is done by a place in Bermuda. That's never going to stand up, is it, in court?
It makes it really hard because, yeah, where is a web business based? Is it based off of where the domain is registered, meaning like the DNS? Like, you know, here with the ICE department has been cracking down on .com domains, where the people who are operating the websites and even hosting the websites in many cases are located outside the US, but they say because they have a .com, which is technically a domain run by the United States, they can shut them down and seize their domain. But what if it's the other way around? You know, the hosting takes place overseas, but the domain is registered, or vice versa. I'm getting the wrong. But yeah, for any place, you can have cached servers, you can have, you know, various local caches that and PayPal or whatever international pay service may be in a different country. There's so many different companies, so many different countries where a single company may operate to have its web presence.
The web presence could be in one country and it's a multinational country. I mean, for instance, I don't know if you heard, there was some talks a little while ago about Amazon being criticized in the UK because of their offshore practices, and meant that they were paying virtually no corporation tax to the revenue and customs.
Jersey and the like, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, if you start getting punitive things that stop websites from actually performing, then companies will quite right, where a large part of their business is performed online, they may well say, right, okay, well, we're going to challenge this and we're going to go to host the actual website somewhere where there is no restrictions on what we can do.
And then isn't there a problem even with Google? Because Google is based in the US, but their international headquarters are in Ireland, right?
John, you were going to say? Yeah, exactly.
I was going to say, yeah, Amazon have been having the same problem in the States as well about where they pay their sales tax and how much sales tax they have to pay because of the locations where they are.
Well, even state by state, that one.
It varies state by state. So they're basically courting different states about where they can get the best tax breaks and where they should take their jobs. So
I think Maryland is the best place to be registered.
But the point is, we could have had this conversation, and I think this conversation has been had 5, possibly even 10 years ago, and exactly the same points would be brought up. Nothing's changed, really. It's just the fact that a hell of a lot more companies doing a hell of a lot more business to a hell of a lot more people.
No, I think the tracking of users' activities is sophisticated to a degree that is disproportionate.
It's another element to something which is completely obfuscated by the fact that the companies operate globally now. And the fact is that the web was built on an internet which was not intended really for this purpose. And all that's happened is everyone's gone, well, that's a brilliant idea, set up a business on it, and haven't thought of, well, they've either thought tactically about the best way to either make money or minimize their risks, either legally or financially, by segregating things in the way that Sarah was indicating. But no thought has been taken of the actual global effect on these things. And now governments are trying to take these almost unilateral views on, as you say, we've got ICO who's trying to do it in the UK. And you, how much effect is that going to have if everybody just goes, oh, sod this, I'm going to host my domain abroad? It is something that that the government couldn't do then, and is going to have funny, very difficult to do now.
When you've got a company that have a very high percentage of their turnover is based on the web, like Amazon, they've got a financial incentive to do that. If the alternative is people are just going to say, "Nah, I don't want to do that," so I'll cancel. You know, they've lost a customer.
Have you seen that the PayPal founder is involved? I think he's an investor or something in this this weird little company that's trying to build floating island nations in international waters where they can have sort of a, what would you call it? Little experiment cities, libertarian, they're not even cities, but I mean, they're city size, but they'd be sovereign nations that are on floating platforms, not unlike one of those oil platforms where you've heard of some websites being hosted in international waters. Then you get the hackers and the BitTorrent crowd talking about launching satellites into space to convey their traffic around in a satellite network orbiting Earth. So it's like, how do the laws even extend to things like that?
Yeah, it's the Radio Caroline of its day, isn't it, Ewan?
Well, there's an old guy who's he doesn't go there anymore, but he took a military gun installation that was used for World War II, and it's a concrete pylon that goes down, you know, a couple of hundred yards into the North Sea, and it's got this facility on the top of it with gun platforms on it, and he bought it and declared it to be a sovereign nation. And I was reading an article in the Times on it years ago, and it's decked out palatially. This guy was a millionaire, but he got wind through a friend of a friend at Whitehall that that Britain was about to extend their international the boundary of international water was about to go out to 18 miles. So he registered a claim with the United Nations to expand his to 18 miles the day before, and it's John le Carré type stuff.
It's called the Principality of Sealand.
That's it. Yeah.
It's run by a family of mental cases, essentially.
But don't the Pirate Bay have some servers hosted there, or is that just talk?
Yeah.
There's a whole series made by a guy called Danny Wallace, which is called How to Start Your Own Country, and he went and visited them in one of the episodes, and they were mad, absolutely mad.
So is it true?
It's a true story.
The guy lives on his own island. Yeah, if you Google the Principality of Sealand, it's an absolutely real place.
Wow.
So yeah, and he lives there completely under his own jurisdiction. I can't remember if he calls himself the king. The leadership is called the House of Bates, and it's run by a guy called Roy Bates.
Okay, guys, let's go and set up a principality called British Tech. We wouldn't be able to be British, would we?
Tone in the chat room suggests that does he have Thunderbird 5 there?
I don't remember seeing it on the program, but you should look that show up. It's very funny.
No, it's the guy was very rich and a bit, you know, Lord Bathish, and but his wife was an ex model or something. She was a stunning woman, but she refused to go out to the platform in the end. She hated it. So white space has become the first. Cambridge has become the first place in the UK to get white space as a trial. Now, white space has been going on already, hasn't it, in the States, Eric? Use of the white space
Not really. I think the FCC recently gave the okay, but I don't think it's ever been implemented beyond a proof of concept experiment.
Right. So apparently we've got what is white space?
I was going to ask the same question.
It's the bit left over.
What I'm thinking of is for serving internet to rural communities, and Cambridgeshire is flat.
Oh, that's why it's working.
Get it further that way, isn't it?
Yeah, no line of sight problems.
Does it use particularly low frequencies or something? Because obviously that would be better for transmitting.
I think it uses unlicensed space in cities. It's location aware, and then it uses space that is unlicensed for TV or radio use. But I think I have that right.
Mm.
Yeah, no, it's the bit that's left over at the end.
In this country, we're slowly moving away from what used to be medium wave in terms of radio, and everything's moving to DAB and digital and everything else. So that space potentially becomes available, and that would be very useful for large-scale Wi-Fi.
Post-digital switchover. God help us all.
Yeah, I was going to say, James would probably know a bit more about that.
Yeah, here we go. I double-checked on Wikipedia. In telecommunications, white spaces refers to frequencies allocated to broadcast in a large block, isn't a station broadcasting.
Stop. Yeah, James and Eric were talking over it. Say that again, Eric.
Are you serious? I never even heard James's voice.
No, you guys were over the top, and I was telling you to stop, and neither of you were listening to me. So, Eric.
Skype. We need white spaces for Skype. According to Wikipedia, in telecommunications, white spaces refers to frequencies allocated to a broadcasting service, meaning, you know, large blocks like TV spectrum, radio spectrum, but not used locally. So in your city, you may not have a broadcaster on that frequency, so your computer could, in theory, hop onto that.
In theory. And James, you said...
Well, I was going to say that actually because of the digital switchover in the UK, a lot of this white space has been freed up. Although I understand that certainly in the case of DT in the chat room, and more people, I think, than it would appear, are having trouble with Freeview, as in the bits that are left behind. What they're doing is they're just trying to shuffle everybody into a small band of frequencies and leaving the rest free, either to be sold off or to be used as this white space. And I imagine that the project in Cambridge is using existing white space as it is now, but that's only going to be for either for a limited time or a small amount, because the spectrum is pretty full already. There isn't a huge amount of white space left.
No, this is unregulated, unlicensed.
Yeah.
So Ofcom's not going to interfere.
They're probably just testing the concept, I would think.
Yes. But it's been declared as a success. So it
still has to go via Ofcom for them to make sure that it's not going to interfere with anything else, but which it may well do.
Well, they're saying
the problem I think they had in the States. They're pretty much giving up on it, I think, and they're massively in debt. I think it's Light Squared, the company that owns the rights to have like a bigger network out there at the moment, and they're having big financial problems because they realised that in some cases it interferes with sat navs. So, they're not too popular in the States at the moment because of that.
It's actually a big it's a big fight, because LightSquared's claims, and a lot of supporters, you know, just fans, tech followers, claim that it would absolutely not interfere with GPS. And so it's sort of a conspiracy or the GPS, big lobbies for GPS are saying that it interferes, and LightSquared says it does not interfere at all. So it's just a back and forth fight. But I think the latest is the FCC ruled that it does interfere with GPS, and that LightSquared cannot go forward with sort of a mesh wholesale wireless bandwidth network that was designed to compete with the likes of AT&T and Verizon.
Which is a shame for them, because that essentially makes their company worthless. I think it was the military that flagged it initially and complained about it and said that it interfered with their satellite navigation.
Yeah.
So. Yep.
Well, they're bothered because their GPS is the only accurate one. Because they can turn down the civilian one, can't they? Too, they can get accuracy down to ridiculously bad amounts, you know, 20 to 30 yards and stuff.
How is it that those satellites are there, and we can all have everyone has a phone and an iPad and five different devices that just hop onto them for free?
Well, it doesn't hop onto them, does it? It receives a signal and it triangulates the signal.
Okay, so they're just broadcasting sort of a beacon.
Yeah, I mean, you can do two-dimensional location with two satellites, and you can do three-dimensional location with three satellites for altitude.
Okay, got it. So the satellites are basically just broadcasting a beacon of their location, and then you just pinpoint, that one, and that one?
Well, it's just basically, I know how far I am from that one, I know how far I am from that one, I know how far I am from that one, so I must be at this point on Earth.
Okay.
And so, of course, if you've got some interference on that frequency stopping you from being able to receive the satellite signal, which is a long way away... you know, you can have a really tough time getting a satellite, getting a GPS signal at the best of times, due to line of sight, due to weather conditions, and therefore any frequency, any kind of transmission that could, even as a harmonic, interfere with the satellite reception is going to hinder you.
I mean, let's be just perfectly clear here that the concern is not over Mrs. Miggins driving into the wrong driveway or or, you know, off a cliff or into a lake or something like that. This is the difference for the GPS system for the military of shoving a missile in the wrong building. It's that's the wrong town.
The danger is a nuclear tipped bunker buster going to the wrong address.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, Google have got my street address wrong. So, I mean, you know, the house that's supposedly me isn't me. And if ever I go so far along with this show that the US military decides to target my house, the bloke down the street's got a hell of a shot coming. I can tell you.
I was just going to make a point that, you know, I was just thinking about what was just said about using this for the way James described it. And I think when you actually think about what the lower frequencies are used for in terms of radio, it is one-way transmission. And I think that makes it a really ideal use of that space.
Hmm.
So I really think that would be such a great idea if they were to use at least some of that, so that it enables you to be able to coordinate in that way. And it's a cheap way of doing GPS and reliable as well, being low frequency.
Put the British tech show on every single frequency when you're doing anything else.
Yeah.
By the way, you guys are going to laugh at me because you'll tell us my age is the reason that I was just never taught this or never was even exposed to this in the news and basic conversation. But I just saw Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol on Blu-ray. And, you know, there's that scene where a nuclear warhead is launched from a submarine. And I watched that and I thought, they can do that? Like, I've never seen that happen. I didn't know that that's been around since like the 60s. How did it boggles my mind. We were talking about the moon landing last week happening in the 60s. And again, I don't understand how they could have done that with how primitive the computers were back then. How could they have guided missiles? I was looking it up on Wikipedia that split off. What do they call that? Well, then they have like 12 different warheads that hit individual targets. How could they have done that before we even had personal computers? Or, you know, relative computing power.
The intercontinental ballistic missile has been around for
part of the reason why we got here.
Mm.
What? Why we started British Tech News?
No, you know what I mean.
The interesting thing, Eric, is that actually when they launch a submarine, when its submarine launches a missile, everyone thinks that it powers up and it fires the rocket in the thing. It doesn't. It actually uses pressure. And the missile is sucked out, and the propulsion of it being sucked out throws it into the air, and then the thing fires.
How does it know when it's above water?
It's timed, plain and simple.
How does it guide?
And when it gets to the top of the piece cylinder, of string,
there are no wings. How does it guide itself across the other end of the world? You know, up into the atmosphere, curvature of the Earth, and then down into a specific city.
Directional thrusters and GPS. It's gimbaled, isn't it? So it can't. You know what a gimbal is?
No.
Gyroscopes, three gyroscopes. So if you put three gyroscopes at different axes, you maintain exact position because everything moves around it. So if you get a gyroscope and set it off in your hand, it becomes very difficult to turn your hand because the gyroscope gimbal, always that, wants to go into.
That the old fly-by-wire was, right?
Well, the gimbal was the three gyroscopes was the original thing that MIT did to do autopilots. And there was a guy sat in the back of a plane and flew the whole plane the whole way from Boston to LA and never looked out the window once. And it was dead accurate. And it was that principle of the fact that the three gyroscopes constantly spinning meant that there was perpetual motion in one direction and it couldn't be changed.
You see, Eric, if you thought that was clever, the fact that GPS doesn't work in space and they can still send, you know, they managed to send people to the moon and get them back to pretty much the right place is just unthinkable.
Even the technology they had at the when time. It had all gone completely horribly wrong, Apollo 13.
How the hell? That is some serious calculations they needed to do.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, the original idea of sending missiles up through outer space to come back down on a different place of the planet, how the hell did they do that? You couldn't have just done that if it hadn't worked.
I mean, it's just bizarre to think that it was, it's like little cavemen in a capsule up there that were landing on the moon. I mean, they were basically blind. They had no access to sophisticated mathematical crunching. Maybe this is not really founded that I would feel this way, but if someone told me that you could do that now, I don't know if this was a joke or a rumor or what, but there was a photo that was showing of the North Korean missile test. There was someone making fun of the fact that their mission control was just two guys in front of two computers. And I was thinking, well, you know, given our technology now and distributed computing and how much power is in each, you know, of the modern Intel chips compared to what it was like in the early days of atomic launching and space launching, that could certainly be their mission control because we have enough CPU power to do that. But it just amazes me that, you know, like you said, Apollo 13, they're up there, they were flying around doing the calculations with a pencil and paper, had no idea what their controls were even telling them.
Yeah, the North Korea thing didn't really work very well, but the fact that people are building rockets, they're on the edge of space travel now, building maybe universities, but actually small companies building things that don't actually get to the edge of the atmosphere, using no more technology than we've got available now, and a bunch of seriously high powered rocket motors. It's not easy these days, I think.
Well, it's not all rocket science.
Here's one in the chat room points out that it was a bunch of dudes with slide rules getting them home, getting them back to Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's get back to logs.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. Logs. Don't get me started on logs. This podcast and all the others like it would not be possible without UK2. We have got a... I hope you've got a pencil and paper ready, because I'm trying to find the email now that's got the codes in it. We have got more codes than phones for you. The complexity of what you can and can't buy from UK2 now and how much you can or can't get off it is incredible. We're going to have to put these up on the website, so do bear with us. Basically, if you type in British Tech DNS, so forget about Bagel Tech and Bagel DNS and all that, it's gone. Can't use those anymore. They don't work anymore, actually. Alex Fox tried to use them last night and they didn't work, so that's how I know that they don't work anymore. British Tech DNS, that will give you free DNS for 2 years. Okay, so if you think that gives you a good deal, that's fine, stick it in. British Tech Domains will get you 20% off domain registration to start with. British Tech VPN will get you 50% off your first month of a VPN server. That's quite a good sum of money, I can tell you. So that's very generous of them. And British Tech Server will get you £50 off any gigabit server on a contract length online deal only. There you go. And the last one, which is brilliant, is British Tech VPS. And that'll get you the first month free when you purchase an entry-level VPS, or the same amount of $8.95 off your purchase price, whichever's the cheaper. There you go. So we've now got five options for you for UK2. You can sit in there, go in and figure out which one's the best one for you. The beauty about them is you can put a couple in at a time. So if you've bought a VPS server and you've bought a domain, you can use both of those codes and you'll get the amount off the domain name and the one off the VPS as well. So it all works together, don't worry. We're going to have to put a little kind of what does this mean chart up. We'll stick it underneath the bageltech.net logo so you can open it in another window and you can still see it there. But UK2 have been fantastic. They sponsor the Marussia F1 team, who we're following as well on the F1 show. I'm going to see the guy from UK2 this week about what we're going to do with the F1 show and Marussia and stuff. So there might be something really exciting coming along, I promise you. And we're just totally grateful to them. Please, please, please support UK2, because they support us and they're loving us at the minute. You guys are buying stuff in your droves. So thank you very much to you for supporting us by supporting them. Please, please, please look after them. We've got a wee competition for the chat room. Mm. We're going to give away a fantastic copy of Camtasia 2, and we're going to give away a copy of Snagit 2 as well from the wonderful TechSmith. Thank you very much, Betsy Weber. She's the lady that's given us the licenses for these to give away. We're going to give away two on the Mac show tomorrow as well. You can work with Windows or with Mac. It doesn't have to be just Mac, so please do feel like you can enter. You've got to be in the chat room, though, so if you're listening to this on podcast, you missed out, I did say. But come back in another couple of weeks and we'll have some to give away. All I want to know is I want the chat room to analyse for me, while we do the cool thingies, what the WWDC logo's about. It doesn't have to be accurate. It can be just entertaining. But I want an analysis, please, of what the WWDC logo is all about. And when it's there, I'll give a prize away. We've got one entry already. New chips. Well done, Trip. Could be.
Is it the speckly apple thing, yeah?
The speckly apple thing, yeah. I've just shown it. There you go.
I have an idea, but I won't say.
Okay. Well, you can say yours at the end, but you've already got a couple of Camtasia, so.
I put my idea in the chat room.
Let's do cool thingies. I think Jules is not going to win it. Bad luck, Sarah. Right. Cool things. James, what have you got for us, mate?
Ewan, you've got an iPhone.
I have. I've got a 4S now.
Okay. How many songs can you play off your iPhone?
I've got 64 gig available, so that's a fair old bit.
Mm-hmm.
20,000, I guess, more.
Really? Well, I've got maybe a little bit less than that, because I think I've got 9,000 on my 64 gig iPod Touch. However, my iPhone here, 15,000 tracks. It's an 8 gig iPhone.
How do you do it? We've never met before, have we?
No, we haven't.
Go on, then.
A fantastic piece of software called Stream2Me. Wherever you are, either on Wi-Fi or on 3G, you have access to your whole iTunes library. And it's got a really effective way of loading. It's basically your iTunes library that can be streamed over 3G. So any track you like by any artist, you can go through the artist list and play a track. So this actually, the files aren't on my machine. There we go. I'm not going to go for them. Not going to go for them either. 808 state. There we go.
Does it support iTunes state metadata like ratings and playlists?
It's not got all of the, it can do playlists, but it can't do the ratings because it uses an XML file based on the iTunes data. But yeah, so it's playing Pacific State. Now. It's probably playing it. There you go.
It's playing it quietly.
Does it require transcoding, or can it play, you know, AAC, Apple Lossless, anything you happen to have?
It can play practically anything that your library can play. I don't know they can do the encrypted stuff. Because it uses,
right,
I don't
right.
know, it may be able to, I haven't got any of that stuff, but it can do videos as well. So it can basically play your whole iTunes library, including video. Obviously, you need a fairly robust connection to do that. But I love it. It's how much was it? I had it up at...
I was just about to say, if it's 25 quid, then I've got a better solution, but...
It's around about 3 quid.
It's about 3 quid.
If you haven't got Wi-Fi, though, surely it's going to use a ton of... bandwidth.
Well, you'd be surprised. If you're playing 192K, not really. It's only the same as streaming internet radio. I listen to internet radio on my way to work sometimes. You know, there's no difference to that except you get to choose the music and have access to. If you're at a party and you want to be able to play some stuff on your iPhone and you haven't got the track with you, you can go to your home library and pick it up. Really effective.
Very good. Yeah. I like that.
It's called Stream to Me. Really excellent support from the guy. I've got a Windows machine. I was using a NAS connection to a mapped drive. And basically, the Stream to Me service on the local machine runs as a service. But because it didn't authenticate to the NAS using my user account, it couldn't get the data. And he explained it to me in an email, and I did it, and now it works. So he was really helpful as well. So I can't fault them on the customer support. And I think when you get a small developer writing a really useful app and you can communicate with them directly, that's when the whole experience becomes a really good one.
Yes, especially if you're using it in a non-standard, slightly different way, James, which is good, described.
Try and do that.
No, it's good because it helps the development of the product as well.
Yep. Good pick.
So, good stuff.
Thank you, mate. And 3 quid, not too bad at all. Now then, Mr. Hume, first go. Cool thingy, Virgin.
First go.
Better be good. So, better be good.
To pop my cherry, I am obsessed with an app at the moment called Paper, which I'm sure you guys have talked about before at length. But the thing that is missing for me is a good stylus, and I'm hoping that I've found one. It's called the Sensu Brush. It's a former Kickstarter project that made it through the funding round. And it is a combination of a rubber-tipped stylus as well as having a capacitive brush. So you can use the rubber end for doing fine detail, and then you can use the brush end for doing the nice watercolor style effects that you can do within paper. And it's what I think I need. So, there's some very interesting videos of people using it. The only thing that I'm missing now is some sort of talent, which I'm still working on. But, we'll see. We'll see if I can get there or not.
Right.
And that is available from May.
Now, this is touch-sensitive, though, as well, isn't it, the Sensu?
It is, yeah.
I know he's called it a Sensio, then, which is it's a coffee maker. But
careful.
Yeah, but this one's touch-sensitive, whereas a lot of the others are speed-sensitive. So paper struggles because, I think you're still going to have the same problem.
Yeah, I have the problem with paper where I get a bit overconfident and then start going too quickly, and then the lines get thicker as you go faster. So I think something like this where you can... But I think the nice idea about the brush end is that it's not as wide, so you can actually see a lot more of what you're doing. So, and thank you for the suggestion of downloading some talent. I will definitely do that. So, the Daily Mail might block me from doing it, but I'll try.
Ms. Gray, what do you have for us?
I don't have a cool thingy, but I have something I want to mention about. As you may know, Monday was the 30th anniversary of the ZX Spectrum.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to give that some recognition because it was the first home computer that I actually wanted. I didn't particularly like the ZX80 or 81, but the ZX Spectrum I thought was a great computer.
Right. Excellent. It was a very good computer. Thank you. Eric, go on, mate. This is going to be the third week in a row.
opendns.com.
Oh, good pick.
Why not?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it is really good. I am a reconvert. I actually don't remember why I ever stopped using them. I think there was an issue when I switched to Comcast. They said they were telling me that their DNS server was so much faster or something because it was on a higher class. I don't know. But I was reading up on OpenDNS again, and they were describing their super fast servers, and there's one within a few, a city or two over from me, which is probably even closer than Comcast. So I figured, why not? And it was really cool. Since I last used them, they've added some features. They started the whole thing, and I knew it would happen as soon as I clicked off of it. Now I can't get back on. They called it, what was it, Fish Tank, I think, with a PH, which is something that they've started, a database that any user can submit to of known phishing scams that use that hijack your DNS or that spoof. You know, you think you're going to PayPal, but you're really going to some fake address. OpenDNS will block that for you, which means no software to install. If you put it on your computer, all applications will be blocked as necessary. And if you put it on your router for your office or school or business, all computers will be blocked from that. And what I was trying to set up just now is I saw it say that if you do sign up with an account, which is totally optional, you can have some kind of statistics. I wonder if it's bandwidth monitoring. That could be super useful now that all these ISPs want to start charging for, or, you know, per gigabyte. So opendns.com, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I use it as well, Eric.
Excellent. Well done, mate. You picked. Good. There's James's ZX Spectrum. Oh, look at that!
Oh, he's got one.
I was playing Chucky Egg on its 30th birthday.
Oh, please bring it to this. Please bring it to the bash, James.
I've got to do what I want to do is I want to do the composite video out mod on it, so you can plug it into a television SCART socket rather than the UHF connector, which makes everything look really crap.
Mm.
Well, it was though. Be fair.
Yeah. Oh, Chucky Egg. Is it? My son played Chucky Egg for a good 10 minutes before he got bored of it. Like, that's pretty good for an old Spectrum game.
He needs jetpack. That'll keep him happy. I've got I'll bring my Binatone down and we'll try and figure out how to connect it through an aerial socket. Yes. There we go. Brilliant. My pick, I got a good kick in this week. I went to one of the reviews. We've got some nice reviews. Thank you, everyone who's left a review. It makes a world of difference to our rankings in iTunes. But Mike Smith left me a review this week for the Big Show, and it said, "For some reason, I always seem to join late or completely miss the live Big Show on Thursday evenings. Great to re-listen again on the podcast. The only criticism I have is that Ewan sometimes falls into the trap of talking yank." I'm sure I'm sure I caught him saying mall this week. Come on, Ewan, you know the Westfield Mall. Come on, it's a shopping centre. Please note the spelling. Centre. There we go. Thank you, Mike. You're absolutely right. It is the Westfield Shopping Centre. It's not a mall. But the reason I said mall was that my family live in Detroit in Wayne, and the nearest mall for them is the Westfield Mall. So it kind of just tripped out. Sorry, there you go. I shall refrain from speaking yank. Other people that have left us reviews: Fabulous Tech Podcast to listen to, perfect for you. Seriously, the Big Show's Big Show covers all the British Tech Network Big Show covers all the interesting tech points of the week whilst keeping you entertained with good humour and friendly banter. Gem in the podcast library. Thank you very much, Anders UK. If you'd like to leave us a review, they make a world of difference to our iTunes rankings. Please, please, please stick a review in. And we're very grateful. Now, the reason that I've got that link is because my pick, I got in the Westfield Mall.
Shopping centre.
There we go. And the Westfield Shopping Centre has got a web or a kind of thing in there that's like all things bloke. It's got tons of stuff that's utter crap, like practical jokes and fake turds and those kind of things. But what was in there...
Boys.
Was a ZX Spectrum bag.
Ooh.
And it was 40 quid in there. And I thought, stuff that. I didn't like the ZX Spectrum that much. So I came home and looked online, and it's $19.99 at Retro Stuff. There you go.
Good.
So I've ordered one.
Oh, cool.
There you go. ZX Spectrum.
Can I tell
you
the story with my brother?
No.
ZX81, and he took he was at sixth form college, and he thought it would be cool to take the insides out of my ZX81 and use it as a pencil case.
Oh, what a get. Hey!
Sorry.
I'm sure I heard Ewan say colour without the U earlier on, says Paul. Thank you, Paul. You're absolutely right. And is the Pentagon brainwashing Ewan? Thank you. Mm. And I said janitor earlier on. Well, janitor's a British word. I'm not having that. It's not yank.
What do you normally say? Custodian?
Caretaker.
Yeah. Oh.
Custodian.
Oh, you don't say, oh, because we say that here, custodian. We had school custodians was what we called the janitors in school.
We haven't said custodians since 1300.
Really?
This is beginning to feel like an advert for Worlds Apart, Ewan.
It is. No, it's...
Missy do it, shall we?
Yes. Missy's command of UK swearing has increased rapidly. I think she's
very good.
She's close to being a sailor from what she was going on this week. Super Missy swears like a good one. Good show. Worlds Apart. If you've not listened yet, go and have a listen because it's a fab show. It's Carl and Missy just talking about all things Britain, America, and the separation between the two. And they kind of freewheeled it this week. And there was tons of stuff. I was sitting listening to it going, no, go on and talk about because that's an issue. And
we'll have Missy talking Cockney before you know it.
Apples and pears. Well, that's the thing. I think that's got to be the next thing is Cockney rhyming slang because there's nothing close as an American answer.
Oh, we could do a whole series on that.
Yeah.
What did you say? Rhyming slang?
Cockney rhyming slang, yes. You've not
apples
come across
and pears apples is and chairs, pears. By the way, Eric.
No, it's not. It's stairs.
Oh, is it stairs? Sorry.
Apples and pears is stairs.
God, I'm rusty and I'm probably the closest one of all of us to Bo Bells.
Yeah.
Good. I shouldn't
have. So
we will have to send Eric an album of Chaz and Dave favourites.
Bish Bosh. Bish Bosh is Dosh, Cash, money. Eric's lost. He's got that look. Eric gets that look where his mouth just drops and his eyes rapidly go left to right in the top of his head like he's about to have a seizure.
He's trying to understand it. The brain can't compute.
So, and fanny packs as well. They discussed fanny packs the other week. Though. You should listen, Eric. You should listen to Worlds Apart, mate. You'll enjoy
it. I should. I learned something. It would help me study up for this show.
You would. You'd come back with an awful lot of stuff. I mean, Missy now just constantly says bloody hell with a British accent all the time. So
that sounds funny. Hell. Could be your translation kit, Eric.
Where can we get a hold of you then, Mr. Hart?
You can get hold of me when I've got my Twitter account, a Twitter client set up for me, Sinclair Spectrum, SYZYGY on the old
Twitter.
You're
not joking, are you?
Someone's going to release that as an iOS app. Twitter for ZX Spectrum. That would be perfect. Mr. Hume, good debut, mate. I'd say you got a hat trick. Well done. You'll do.
Thank you.
Where can
Hopefully you'll ask me back one day.
You will. You'll be back soon, mate. No worries at all. Where can we get a hold of you?
You can find me on Twitter at Hume Dini, which is HUMEDINI, or at johnhume.co.uk.
And what you need to do is offline now talk to Sarah about a web show.
This could definitely be arranged.
That would be good.
We've been wanting a web show for quite a while.
I've just been really tardy about it.
Well, I would love to be involved with that.
Right. There you go. You've got someone to hold your hand, Sarah. You're not on your own anymore.
Mm.
Do it.
Yes.
Well done. Sarah, where are you, Mrs.?
I'm on the Twitters at Sarah Jane UK.
Excellent. Thank you, girl. And last but by no means least, Mr. Lanigan.
EricLanigan.com and the Twitter.com/TheEricLanigan. Wait, why did I say that? Eric Lanigan, ERIKLANIGN. It's just that. There's no the.
No J in it.
No, just that. There's no the.
Have you registered Eric the Lanigan. Eric Lanigan just in case?
No, I have to. Why did I say that? I thought it sounded just kind of funny, and then it's like, wait, that's a different URL entirely. Don't use that.
And you stuck a J in it as well.
Now's the time when someone in chat should go and register it if it's not already taken and start a spoof account.
Yeah, I'm the Eric Lanigan and just post loads of stuff. Oh, mate, the dirt. Lanigan. The dirt we could find.
I think it's available. Go for it. Go.
No. Eric, do it.
I don't get what the chat room's offer one. There we go. I'm Ewan Rankin. You get me at Ewan Rankin on Twitter, and you can follow the network on at British Tech Network. British Tech News. Have we got a winner in the competition? I got to say, I quite liked... I'd forgotten the competition. Thank you, mate. I quite liked... Where's he gone? Paul Davis's. I didn't actually. A lot of people seem to think I actually wanted their Jungian-esque responses to what that logo actually was, and I didn't. I wanted something witty. But I can't find Paul's note. Where's he gone? Paul Davis. The Apple logo through tinted rose-tinted spectacles. There we go. I thought that was quite good. And where did Tones go? Apple's first logo in Magic Eye picture format with a 3D Retina display.
Yeah, I could see that.
Yeah, I could do that. That's cool. But
only with your crossed eyes.
Well, I think it's lots of different screen sizes. There you go. I think because there's the iReader coming.
Can I say mine?
7-inch. Go on, Eric. What's yours?
I think it's just a bunch of abstract, semi-rectangular, rounded rectangle icons for iOS. Just tilted, you know, 90 degrees or 45, I guess.
iOS. Mm. Yeah.
I think it does look good there. I like it.
You're a boring bastard, Lanigan.
I know. That's so boring. I can find no conspiracy or meaning in that whatsoever.
I used to love the old logo with the stripes on it. The different colored stripes, and I thought it was really boring. I could totally understand why they did it in terms of going to a single color, because that's makes it a lot easier for branding.
Is,
but
is this an actual manifestation of the Apple reality distortion field?
That is the reality distortion field. Fair enough. There we go. Paul Davis, send me an email and claim whether you want Camtasia or Snagit too. From TechSmith. They've been wonderful to us. Thank you very much, TechSmith. Please support them if you possibly can. And Tone, send me the same email. Tell me which one you want, and I'll pick which one, which wants the other. Hopefully, you'll both pick the opposite. So. Windows and Mac licenses, so it doesn't make any difference. Just fine. It's just only Linux it doesn't work with. Did you see the Linux picture this week? There was a picture of Mac, and it got a picture of a scooter, dependable, but it just works. And then there was the next one was Windows, and it was a high-powered motorbike, and it looked super slick and dandy. And then the last one was the motorbike taken to pieces. It just had Linux written underneath it. Yeah. Sorry, sir.
I didn't get that, but it should say Linux. It just works. You just can't use it.
That's a matter. Whoa, Mr. Lanigan.
That's a whole other podcast.
That was underneath.
While these two duke it out, I'm going to say goodbye. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back again with the Mac Show tomorrow at 2 o'clock. No, Photo Show at 2 o'clock, Mac Show at 3:30. And then we've got. No, there's no F1 on Monday, so we're not doing it. There we go. See you next week. Thanks for listening.